I do want to give a sermon today that will follow somewhat the theme of the weekend, perhaps a little variation on that particular theme. I'm not going to talk too much about single people, though I will allude to them in the sermon. I want to talk primarily about marriage and why some of us have problems in our marriage. Maybe yours is perfect. Mine has been wonderful, but it's not been perfect. So, you know, I have to deal with problems in mine, and you probably have to deal with some problems in yours. And over the years, my water. Now, I do need some water. Thank you very much to you. Is he single? I don't know. He has a serving spirit, so... When I analyze, when I have to deal with marriage problems as a minister, which often happens, I'm astounded and a little unsettled by how little the partners in troubled marriages understand about each other, and specifically the differences in approach that make men and women unique and dissimilar in so many ways. I talk to people who've been married 30, 40, 50 years, and they don't understand each other yet. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, does it? But it's so frequent. People can live together in the same house, eat, sleep, spend their lives together, and yet there is this mental wall between the two, and they can't reach over it. It's been said that men are in general more analytical than women are. I think that is a generalization that is valid. Not always true, but usually is. I think it has been said that women are in general more intuitive than men. Women can sort of figure stuff out. There's this funny thing women can do where they don't go, ooh, 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 but they just sort of... and then they read people's minds. You know that your mama could do that when you were a kid. She could read your mind. Your dad couldn't, but your mama could. How come? It's a bit of a joke, and yet, if you think about it, she could sort of read your mind, and she still can. And it's a little scary, and how come she can do that? Well, these are differences. They are quite profound between men and women. It's good to be able to identify them, and once you've identified them, you got to respect them and put them in a spiritual context. If you want to have a successful marriage, that works. You've got to understand each other. You know, there's this classic scenario that so many of you have heard. It's caricatured often in on television, in the comics and things of that type. You have this middle-aged gentleman arriving home from work, and he's exhausted, as middle-aged gentlemen tend to be when they arrive home from work, really frazzled, driving on the crowded roads. And he walks into the house, and he collapses on a chair in the living room. He has his chair. Nobody gets near it. It's his. You know that chair, which, you know, the one that I mean. And he is too shocked to move. He's completely spaced out. He's brain dead for all practical purposes. Now, you have to understand that men have this ability to become brain dead. Women do not. Women always think. Women think endlessly. It never stops. The brain just keeps on kicking over. But men can say, okay, unplug, and it's gone. There's nothing happening in there. And I assure you, ladies, there is nothing happening. Nothing. He's not thinking evil thoughts. Nothing is being thought. He's dead. So this guy is sitting there, he's a noble, he's trying to think, but he's making no progress, and at that point his wife rushes in from wherever she has been, enthusiastically, and she wants to communicate, to use the, trendy bus phrase. She wants to communicate. See, she spent the day, up to that, she's a stay-at-home mom, she spent the day talking to her two-year-old and her four-year-old all day long about Mickey Mouse or chocolate ice cream. And of course the standard usual bathroom activities, and she's tired of all of this, and she's thrilled to see her man. He has come home, and she's looking forward to a meaningful, scintillating discussion with another adult. And here he is, the adult, number one adult in her life. At that point he's still brain dead. She doesn't know that. If she knows it, she ignores the whole idea. She, of course, notices he's not responding, however, to her enthusiastic greetings and overtures. So she gets a little worried, which women automatically do. They always get worried. And she probes a little bit, which is also typically female. She probes. She says, sweetheart, are you okay? You look a little... Are you okay? He looks up at her with a vague annoyance and says, honey, I'm fine. I'm just tired. No problem. I'm just tired, which is true. She then becomes alarmed. So she sticks her finger in his brain again, and she says, are you sure nothing's wrong? You look upset, and you sound upset. Did something happen at work? What happened at work? Something happened. I can tell. He then retorts, sweetheart, he says, sweetheart. Nothing happened at work. I'm just beat. It's been an exhausting day. There's nothing to worry about. Please quit crying. At that point, of course, she begins to feel rejected. And she responds with a little sliver of steel. She says, I am not crying. I am not crying. I am simply concerned. And you're acting as you always do when I'm concerned. You refuse to tell me what's happening in your life. All I want to know is what has gone wrong. I can tell something's wrong. And all I'm doing is out of concern and love as your wife trying to share in your problems. All I want to find out is how your day has been, and you're shutting me out. You've shut me out again. And he then responds with growing anger. I am just tired. I am exhausted, and until I got home, nothing was wrong. But now something is wrong. You have decided to attack me with no basis. And he doesn't finish his sentence. He just gets up out of his chair. He stalks out of the house. He slams the door. And then he does whatever he does. Each man has his typical reaction at that point. Maybe he walks around the block. Maybe he goes and tinkers in the garage. Or maybe he drives off in his car to the local 7-11. She then rushes to the phone because she still needs to communicate. She is in tears, and she calls her mother for sympathy, and they discuss what a dreadful lout this poor girl has had the misfortune of marrying. Of course, the mother agrees totally with that particular concept. That's the end of the scenario. Could you take that rather common caricature and identify what went wrong and why? Because even though it's funny, you know as well as I do that things like that happen in most people's lives all the time, sometimes almost identical to the caricature. You understand why it is so hard for most men to indulge in detailed blow-by-blow accounts of their day in the minutes that follow their arrival home? Because there are some real reasons I could explain to you why it's very hard. Conversely, do you understand why the wife was so starved for adult conversation and why she panicked when her husband didn't respond to that need? Because most women will, and she did, and that's pretty typical as well. Could you explain why he then became very defensive and tense and at that point felt attacked when she persisted in getting him to talk? Now, you know, all of those questions have very basic, pretty clear answers to them. And when you have the answers, that is when the basic differences between men and women have been identified in your mind. And you then commit them to God within the context of your marriage, and you put them in a spiritual context. Those differences can and should become stimulants to growth, spiritual and emotional growth, not just irritants that, you know, drive you apart and wreak havoc in your marriage. I got married in 1963, so it's almost 30 years. And I got married shortly after I was ordained, so I was a bachelor minister for about, 5 months. And I got married 5 months after ordination, not quite 5 months. So when I began to court my wife, I was already the pastor of the Indianapolis, Indiana congregation of the Worldwide Church of God. My wife was a senior at Ambassador College. And it sort of came together in a rather interesting fashion. I was ordained midway through the feast in 1962, and I was still single. And Mr. Armstrong sort of chided me about being the only bachelor minister in the church except for Mr. Waterhouse, but he'd already given up on Mr. Waterhouse. So I was the only victim left. And I was a lot younger than Mr. Waterhouse, so, you know, it looked like maybe Mr. Waterhouse was getting on in the middle age and it didn't matter anymore. But, I was 23 years of age, not quite 23. And he called me up to be ordained at the feast in Big Sandy. And during the first half of the ordination prayer, it was all very nice. He said the usual nice things that you say when you ordain somebody. He asked the Eternal God to set this person aside to the job to which he had been called, and he was a very nice ordination prayer through the first half. But then, very clearly, something dawned on him in the middle of the prayer. A light came on in his head because the whole tenor of the prayer began to change very quickly, and the last half was uncomfortable. Clearly, he realized halfway through that I was a single guy. It had not struck him prior to that, and he had his hands already on me. I was being ordained. He had already made the request, and then suddenly he thought, I don't believe it, he isn't married. The whole prayer changed. He stopped ordaining me and began to ask God to provide me with a wife. Rather insistently, in fact. And he expressed the fact to the Eternal God that this young man, who is now unfortunately a minister, as of 5 seconds previously, was not married, that he couldn't give sermons on marriage or on shawl ring or on practically anything that was any value, and he had to find a wife very quickly. And I stood there as this continued on. Mr. Armstrong was a wonderful man who was very, very transparent, and when he thought something, it came out his mouth very quickly. And very clearly he was thinking about my single state, and that then monopolized the rest of the ordination prayer. If you've ever been to the ordination of a minister, sometimes it can be very moving, and everyone is sort of wet-eyed when it's all over. But in this case, nobody was wet-eyed, but a lot of people were laughing. So much for my ordination. Anyway, he said, "Eternal God, provide him with a wife quickly." So I left with this ringing in my ears. Now, that occurred in the middle of the feast in 62. The last day of the feast was 4 days later, so I had to work fast. 4 days later, I had to stay behind to do the final anointings. That was because, you see, all the other ministers left with their families, notice families, wives and children, and since there were some final anointings on the last day of the feast, they picked me because I was the only single guy in the ministry, and I wasn't really quite, you know, I wasn't a real minister. I was the one who, you know, got ordained halfway. So I had to stay behind to do the final anointing, so I guess I was at the bottom of the pecking order. I mean, I was below the pecking order at that point in time, see. It was about 8 o'clock that evening. Everyone had left to go home, as usually happens. We called it the old tabernacle. The field house, as it's now called, was virtually empty. A few of the final sick and ill had been anointed by me in a little room in the hallway to the side of the field house where we did the anointings. And it was all done, so it was time out when I could leave, and I came out of the little room, walked down the hall to go to my car, and lo and behold, there was a young lady walking down this same hall toward me. Now, she was not sick, nor was she ill, and she'd not asked to be anointed. It was also rather strange that she was in the hallway all by herself, because the hallway went no place. It was a dead-end hall with no door at the end of it, and she had to turn around and go the other direction to get out. But she was walking in my direction, and I was walking in hers. Now, that was convenient. I have to tell you that she was a senior in AC, and I had noticed her previously. Now, you single guys know what I mean. I had noticed her. When I was 17, and not yet an Ambassador College student, and she was 16, and a junior in high school, in Imperial High School in Pasadena, I had noticed her then. And I thought to myself, what a pretty girl. But I was a very shy guy, and I couldn't ever work up my nerve to ask her on a date. And then I finished college, and she was in college, and then I was gone. And then they sort of ordained me. Focus on sort of. And there she was, already a senior, and there I was. And Mr. Armstrong's prayer was still ringing in my ears, so I asked her if she would like to go out to dinner with me, 8 o'clock that evening after the feast was over. I didn't ask her what she was doing in the hallway, which of itself would have been an interesting question to pose. But maybe the Eternal had simply placed her there. You'll have to ask her what she was doing there. I have, and she refuses to tell me. Anyway, in fact, she will even tell you that she wasn't in the hallway or something like that, but she was. I don't know how she gets around it, but she manages to. So I took her to dinner in Gladewater, Texas, which is about 5 miles away from the college. There was no place to take a young lady to dinner in those days in Gladewater that was impressive. First date, impressive, afraid not. It was a kind of a yucky restaurant. Today it's called the Shamrock Cafe. It is still there, actually. It's called the Shamrock Cafe. You can imagine what it was like. I think then it was called Crazy Jose's. It was not a fancy place. So we went in there, and it wasn't much of a place, and the food was awful, but I was smitten. And I asked her if I could write to her after she got back to college and I got back to Indiana to my pastorate, and she said yes. And I wrote to her 4 times. I wrote to her twice in November. Feast was in October. Twice in November, twice in December. 4 times. Then in January, I went out to the annual ministerial conference, which was held in Pasadena in those days on the campus of the college. And that's where she was. She was a senior, and I went out to the conference because I was a minister, sort of. And I had determined that I would not go back to Indianapolis, Indiana, bachelor. In fact, I had saved $200. I had $100 for a ring, and I had another $100 for the first month's rent on a furnished house in Indianapolis. I hadn't put it down yet, but I had the $200 in my wallet. And I was determined I would not go back single, and I did not. 3 weeks later, we were man and wife. Now, that tells you something about me at the time. You recognize how immature, translate, dumb, I was. We had a very rapid courtship. We dated for 10 days during the conference. I asked for special permission to stay another 10 days, which Mr. Armstrong gave. He was so thrilled that he... And I told him why he was so thrilled. He was thrilled. And then we dated for another 10 days. That equals 20 days. And on the 21st day after our first real date, we got married. We were strangers. I didn't know her. She didn't know me. In fact, for about a year, she had a hard time calling me by my first name because she'd been taught as a church kid that you didn't call ministers by their first name. And she ended up being married to one, but there was still this block about first names. She didn't call me minister. She didn't call me anything. Now, I was 23 years of age and she was 22, and you'll have to say that we weren't too sharp. We weren't too swift. And that is true. If I could do it again, I would still marry the same lady, no question about that. But I would do it a year later, a whole year later. I would have given us a year. We needed that year to get to know each other. Because I didn't know who she was. I mean, I knew I liked her. I told a lot of people, my wife and I fell in love after we got married. We liked each other before we got married, but we didn't know each other enough to fall in love with each other. We fell in love after we got married. We were sitting across the breakfast table 2 or 3 months after we got married. We used to talk about how, isn't it nice to fall in love? We were, you know. I don't think that's quite what you should do. And you might say, well, you're awful lucky, because a lot of people who do that, it never does happen. Well, it did happen. I could talk about the 50s and the 60s and how, in some ways, how naive we were in the church about some things, but it worked. But we didn't know each other, and you need the time to get to know each other, so I set myself up as a bad example. That's not what you should do. That is what I did, unfortunately. We came to the marriage prematurely. We didn't know each other well. There were some tense moments. I didn't know women all that well. My sisters were born after I went to AC. I have 3 sisters. I have I have a stepsister and 2 half-sisters, but I wasn't raised with them. So women were sort of mysterious. I didn't fully realize, for instance, that women cried in general more than men cry. I didn't know that. Now, that's a generalization, but it's basically true. I didn't know that. I mean, the men I'd been around didn't cry all that much unless they got run over by a truck or something. But in general, that wasn't something that most guys did. I didn't understand that women did do that, often, for things a whole lot less serious than getting run over by a truck. I didn't understand why women did that and why God designed it so. I wonder if you married men remember the first time you made your wife, or probably your future wife, cry by being too blunt or too pushy or too insensitive or too obsessed with some male need to reach a goal. You know, men do that. They get this goal. They're going to do that. And they start doing that. They haven't asked her what she thinks, how she feels, whether she wants to. They're just out there, you know, fulfilling this great goal. And you look around and you think, what's the matter with her? She's crying again. And what did I do? I didn't do anything. I was, you know, and you've been insensitive without even realizing that you've been insensitive. You remember the first time you did that? A lot of men don't. Your wife, I'm sure, does. You want to ask her afterwards, she'll tell you. I remember clearly the first time I did that. We'd been married 6 days, and we got married on a Sunday, and then it took us 2.5 days to get back to Indianapolis, where I was pastor, because I had to go back to my pastorate. I mean, I wasn't going to go on a honeymoon, because I thought that would be sort of carnal and silly. I was a minister, after all, sort of a minister. So we just skipped that whole idea. Now, I tell people nowadays, you need a honeymoon, at least a week, preferably 2. If you got the money, take a month. But, you know, here am I, bright-eyed, 23 years old, sort of ordained. I just skipped it. So we raced back. On Tuesday, we were back. I was back visiting, anointing, being the pastor of the 300 people in Indianapolis. That was Tuesday we were back. And then by Friday, my new wife informed me that we had to wash clothes, and we had no machine in a little apartment I'd rented in Fall Creek Parkway in central Indianapolis. So this was Friday. I dropped her off at 2 o'clock Friday afternoon with instructions to be done by 3. So I wash all the clothes. I dropped her off because I had to go to the bank, and I knew it would take me 1 hour at the bank. 2 to 3, I could do all the banking, and then 2 to 3, she would do all the washing. It was very nicely put together in my mind. You know, it all computed nicely. I told her I'd be back exactly at 3, and would she be finished by then, please? I said, please. And then I mentioned we could then go home, get home by about 3:20 to 20 minutes, and between 3:20 and 5:30, I would work on my sermon for the next day, and then from 5:30 to 6:30, we could eat and have dinner, and then from 6:30 to about 10:30, I could go back to my sermon, 10:30, I could go to bed. I mean, the whole, you know, the day was nicely laid out, systematized. I went to the bank after I dropped her off at 2. I got back exactly at 3, I mean, really right on 3. And I drove in front of the laundromat, and I thought she'd be standing there with this, you know, the basket of clean, dry clothes, waiting for me, and she wasn't there. So I had to park the car, imagine that, get out of the car and walk inside. Now, I didn't consider the fact that you can't wash and dry a big load of clothes in 1 hour. You just can't. I mean, there are other people in there. You know, the big bins that turn to dry your clothes, sometimes those big bins are occupied by other people's clothes, and they won't take them out, even if you say, my husband is coming, please. Can you let me get in before you, because he's on his way? You just can't do that. So it wasn't her fault. But as a husband of 5.5 days, I was a little inflexible. Most guys are when they're 22 or 23. I mean, it's an inflexible time in life. I had to adapt my schedule to somebody else, and that was hard. So So some of the fact that she wasn't standing in front of the laundromat dutifully, you know, clutching a basket of clean dry clothes sort of irritated me. I'd said 3 o'clock. So I walked into the laundromat, and I wasn't loud, and I wasn't angry, but I was probably a little firm in the way I said it. I asked her why she wasn't done. I should have been obvious, but I did ask her why. And she then burst into tears. Now, I'd never seen her do that before. We'd only dated for 3 weeks. And you can't count the one date at the Shamrock Cafe in Gladewater. I mean, that, I'd never seen her crying. Now, she had gotten a little weepy at the wedding, just a little damp-eyed, but this was not a little weepy. This was full bore, full vent. I mean, real crying. Never seen, it was very unsettling. And then she was doing that, and then there were other women in the laundromat. They all looked like Roseanne Barr Arnold. You know who? There were about 5 of them in there, and they were looking at me. Menacingly. And I felt it was better if I just left. That's what you do when you're a new husband and you've set something off and you don't know how to resolve it. You leave. So I went and sat in the car, assuming it would blow over. It didn't blow over. When the clothes were done, 10 minutes later, that's all it took, she came out, put them in the car, and she cried all the way home. And as we drove home, a little light came on in my rather thick noggin. It came on briefly. I realized, albeit confusedly, that I had been a jerk. And at that point, a little change occurred. Not a lot, because remember, I'm just 23. A little mellowing occurred. And I saw I had to apologize. Now, that's tough when you're 23. It's tough when you're any age, but 23, oh boy, apologizing was not in my, you know, bag of tricks. I had to apologize, and I did, as hard as that was. And it made a little difference in my life. It was the beginning of something. It was the beginning of a kind of a process of learning to appreciate who she was and to appreciate the differences and to adapt to them and to change my life in a way that I could become a little bit more effective in dealing with other human beings. I did sense my own insensitivity a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit. And so there was a catalyst to change. And I began to sense, too, that she and I were very different. And I had to come to grips with that and analyze it. I wonder if you've come to grips with that and analyzed that difference in your relationships. I want to focus at this juncture on the fact that God designed us with these differences intact. And God had a purpose in doing so. Genesis 2, if you turn to that, you'll see that men and women are not identical at all. Their approaches to life are in many ways diametrically opposite. And why would God do that? You know, why aren't women more like men? Why set us up to have this hassle? I mean, if we don't understand each other, wouldn't it have been simpler if God had simply made us mentally and emotionally identical so that, you know, that wall wouldn't be there? I mean, why do this? Well, there's some interesting reasons why. We'll get to that. They revolve around conversion and who God is and what He is and what He wants us to become. Genesis chapter 2, let's see, verse 18. We see some focus here on Adam's approach to life, and it hints at a lack of completion in his life. The eternal God said, we've read it many times before, it's not good that the man should be alone. He didn't say it was wrong or a sin. The single state is an honorable state. There's nothing wrong with being single. It just means that there's some gaps in our life when we're single. There's some gaps. There are. That's not too shameful. It's just the way it is. It's not good that the man should be alone. Therefore, I will make him help that is meet for him. Sometimes we translate that word meet by, you know, suitable, and we think, well, that means, suitable, yeah. Identical. A helpmeet identical to him. So single people go out and look for somebody who's identical to them. I counsel with these young guys, these jocks in AC, you know, the jock type who says, well, my life is sports. I mean, is anything that's round or oval-shaped, I kick it, I throw it in the air, I smash at it with a bat or a stick. I mean, sports in my life. I got to marry a girl who's athletic, just like me, who appreciates what I appreciate. I think that's sort of funny. My daughters all married jocks, all my sons-in-laws, all 3 of them, you know, they anything that's around, they kick it, you know, bat at it, push it, shove it, I don't know what they do with, you know, it's just the way they are, you know, it's their life. My daughters are the antithesis of that. They don't have necessarily any great interest in sports. That's not what this means. The fact that, you know, that you love tennis doesn't mean you should marry somebody else who loves tennis. Now, I tell guys like that, hey, get a buddy. You know, get a buddy. Think about marriage later. You got it all wrong. Get a buddy. Helmet and help, the word doesn't mean suitable or identical. It means better in the Hebrew, complementary. The Hebrew implies that they were different, but the differences could be blended. It implies 2 dissimilar elements that can be blended. See, God made the blend possible. It's not impossible, but with His Spirit and with His help. Christ in you is the hope of glory. He's also the hope of your marriage. The blending can occur, but it's meant to occur primarily when there is a supernatural element involved. We are complementary to one another. Men and women are not inferior to one another, nor are we superior to one another. We're simply different. We have different skills. We have different abilities. Overall, there's some overlapping, but not a lot, but there is some. We have a different approach to life, and in that approach, there is not a lot of overlapping. There is a major difference there. Men, for example, tend to focus primarily on things, on plans, on goals, and on tasks. Men are task-oriented. Women tend to focus primarily on people, on attitudes, and on relationships. Women are primarily relationship-oriented. Now, there's overlapping. We both go on the, you know, on to the other side, and we both have some of what the other has. I'm talking about a focus. And this is the backdrop for the way we think, feel, react, respond to others throughout life. All of it starts long before marriage. In fact, those differences start in the womb. When you look at the history of how they all develop, you have to go back to the fetus in the womb. People who study the developmental stages of the fetus tell us some interesting things, and I want to tell you a few things that they tell us today. They tell us that male and female brains are virtually identical in the first 4 months of gestation. They analyze, you know, when there's been an abortion, a spontaneous one, they'll analyze the little brains of little babies. And they can't find any discernible difference in the first 4 months. But around the 4th month of pregnancy, the tiny brain of the male fetus does seem to modify up to a point. There are some changes, and they analyze that. Why does this happen? What's going on? There's a lot of controversy about it. Some things are, however, rather clear. Now, I got to remind you that the human brain is divided into two sides. I think most of us know that. There's the left side and the right side. Sort of like a melon that's been cut a little bit at the top and cut a little bit at the bottom, and you got the left side and you got the right side. And on the left side and on the right side, there are different potentials, there are different talents, there are different things going on in our brains. And we've all got these two sides, these two hemispheres. And something happens around about the 4th month of gestation to the left side of the brain of a male fetus. And again, of course, the ladies who are more in the feminist mode get very unsettled about this and don't want it talked about. And it's talked about less in the USA. You go to Europe, everyone talks about it. You go to Canada, everyone talks about it. But in the USA, the feminist lobby is so strong that the people who look at these things are sort of scared to talk about it too publicly because they get in trouble. But nonetheless, something does occur. Some specialists say that the left side of the male fetus's brain is coated with a coating of chemicals, and that doesn't happen to the female brain. At the same time, they notice things beginning to happen, and they make this connection. A part of the left brain, which contains the speech center and the verbal skills, slows its growth in the male fetus. And people analyze that and say, is it connected to these chemicals? There's a slowing down. There's a decreased ability to verbalize. That clearly inhibits the male child as he grows. And male children will tend to catch up around the ages 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And some people say the left side of the brain finally matures, that the baby girl is already born with that side of her brain a lot further along. A couple of other things. At 4 months of age, that's after birth, it's clearly demonstrable that baby girls will respond much more enthusiastically to the sound of their mother's voices than a male child will. Why is that? Why this verbalization? Why is it more important? Specialists have even measured the length of time that baby girls will remain excited when their mother walks into the room. You know how a little baby will begin to kick their arms and their feet, and you can see by their facial expression that they're excited to see you. So they hear their mother's voice. That time of excitement will last as much as 4 times longer on average for a baby girl than for a baby boy. Why is the little girl more excited by voice, by talking, by verbalization? Why is the male baby less excited by it in general? Question has to be asked. Why is it that little girls will begin to imitate sounds a little earlier, a little sooner, before the male baby will? Boys will do it too, but it'll tend to be a month or 2 or 3 months later than most little girls. And they'll have a harder time articulating the sounds clearly. Stuttering is a male problem. I rarely come across an adult female that stutters. I frequently come across teenage boys and full-grown mature men who have a problem stuttering. Why does the male tend to have that problem and the female does not? Something has been affected on the left side of the brain, and the verbal skills are a little different as a result. Now, that's in part by men of a different approach to talking. You know, people joke about how women talk a lot more than men do, and that's kind of like it's a defect. I don't think it's a defect. I think God fully intended women to talk a little bit more than men do. He made it so that automatically that is what occurs. And one little lesson from that, if you expect your husband to fulfill all of your talking needs, women say, well, my husband, he just doesn't communicate. Linda, he doesn't communicate. I got some news for you, ladies. The vast majority of all males on the face of the earth will never communicate as much as their female counterparts will. I don't know if they're even capable of it without a lot of trying. Are we dealing with nature or are we dealing with nurture? Now, if your husband doesn't fulfill all of your talking needs, that's okay. I see, you need a girlfriend. He needs a buddy, and you need, you need to make sure you get one of these cheap deals with long distance so you can talk to your mother twice a week. I mean, let's get it all back into perspective here. Another major change occurs during the fourth or fifth months of gestation to the fetus of the male that doesn't happen to the female. And again, there is controversy on this. The controversy comes from politicians, mainly female politicians, but some male politicians who don't want us to talk about these things because it does unsettle them. It seems that during the fourth or the fifth month of gestation, the fibers that join the left or analytical side of the brain in the male fetus to the right side undergo this chemical process. There are these chemicals floating around, and they're not floating around in the brain of the female fetus. And apparently this removes or shrinks some of the fibers that link the two sides of the brain together. So in the male fetus, when he's born, there are simply less connectors between the two sides. There are connectors, but there are less, or they have shrunk, or they're not as strong. That means he can still move from the left to the right and from the right to the left, but it is simply harder for him to do that. Now, apparently the growing young girl has no such problem. The connectors are strong. There are a lot of them. She can move quickly from left to right. That might be interpreted by some people as explanation of a certain flightiness that is there in some young women at times, because there is this ability to zoom back and forth, and the male plods arduously from side to side. Now, women can use both with equal facility. Men do not seem to be able to do that, so men walk into one side or the other. As a consequence, male children are in many ways more stubborn than female children are. Generalization, some little girls are very stubborn. But I would say, in general, more male children are harder to sort of deal with. There are more male eccentrics. You ever notice that? The eccentricity tends to be a male trait of character. The male locks into one side. By moving back and forth, the female is able to create a certain balanced focus in life. Very important, especially in the raising of kids. The male locks into one area or the other more easily. Some lock into certain parts of their, their ability much too much. Is it not true that most so-called nerds are males? Go back to the teenage lingo. There are such things as female nerds, but there aren't very many. Lack of balance, being a little funny about this or a little funny about that, we males tend more in that direction. So there is something about these fibers and about our ability to move back and forth that is there. That also explains the uncanny ability men have to tune out or to unplug. Because it is simply easier for us to tune out or to unplug or not to be as aware of all that's going on around us, you see. Women have an incredible awareness. That's why your mama could read your mind. They say women have eyes in the back of their head. Not exactly, but boy, this brain is going like this. She's coming up with clues that the average male isn't going to quite catch to the same degree. You know the scenario. Husband's reading his newspaper, probably the sports page, and he's totally engrossed in it. I mean, he has picked it up, and he's engrossed. He's concentrating on the sports page. Now, around him, pandemonium breaks loose. The dog has begun to bark. He doesn't hear it. He's reading the sports page. The children have begun to scream. Somebody is pulling somebody's hair. He doesn't hear it. He's reading the sports page. The phone has begun to ring. He doesn't hear it. The soup's burning in the kitchen on the stove. He doesn't hear it. Now, his wife has heard, seen it all. She's completely aware of the whole thing. She is in tears, however, because she can't control all of this. There's no way that she could possibly do it. She looks in the room, and she assumes he doesn't love his family. All he loves is his stupid sports newspaper. That's all he thinks about. He doesn't think about us, without realizing that maybe he does love her and loves the kids, but he simply has not heard the phone ringing. He hasn't heard the dog barking. He hasn't seen the soup burning. He has locked himself into that paper, and his mind gives him that ability. He's unplugged, yes, because it is easy for him to pull out those plugs. It's not as easy for women to do that. Very few women ever unplug totally. If you do, but not many, not many. That's why your mother, you know, had that uncanny ability to tell when you were telling fibs when you were a kid. I mean, she had that. And your dad didn't in most cases. Less connectors between the two sides of his brain? I think so. A lot more between the two sides of hers? That seems to be the case. Why did God design it so? Well, the women didn't have eyes in the back of their heads. Would any of our kids live through the 10th year of their life? If you didn't know what was going on back there without actually being able to see back there, would they survive? I doubt it. On the other hand, men need to lock into certain areas. Men are specialists in many ways in terms of jobs and professions. We do tend to specialize. Women on the job market will tend to go into the, you know, the caring fields in some cases because it's a little bit more natural. Women will tend to get an overview that men sometimes will not have. And that's very valuable within a family setting, and a lot of men need to take advantage of that wonderful trait of character. Now, brain dominance doesn't lock us into certain tendencies. I'm not making excuses for people here. You'll recognize that God gives us His Spirit so that whatever is naturally us can be changed. And all the things I'm talking about today can be modified with God's help. I'll look at a couple more differences that go back to gestation. One that's important is that the part of the brain of the male fetus that contains spatial perception abilities, I'm not talking Texan now, S-P-A-C-I-A-L. That's not S-P-E-C-I-A-L. You know there's a difference. In Texas, they say spatial. That's real spatial. But that's not what I mean. This is different. This is spatial, space. That area of the male brain tends to develop a little bit more in the male fetus than in the female fetus. A spatial ability is the knack of identifying distance between you and something else. That's a very fundamental, seminal explanation of that. You and something else. The distance between you, your foot, and a goalpost. Does that ring any bells? Why are little boys attracted to a ball? Why is a goalpost or an area that, you know, you throw something into or toward exciting to a five-year-old boy, but not as exciting to a five-year-old girl? You say, well, that's just society, it's just the way we've been raised by a sexist. You'll find that this is sort of automatic. Little boys at age 4, 5, or 6 will tend to focus on any object that is three-dimensional, that involves distance between parts of the apparatus. Let's say a mobile hanging over the crib of a baby boy is far more fascinating to the baby boy than to the baby girl. And you can do a test if you have a twin, if you have twins, a boy and a girl. At 6 months, put a mobile over the crib and see how long the baby boy will lock into that mobile and stare at it. You know how babies get this goofy look when they sort of, ha, ha, ha. You know that look? Little boys will do that for 15 or 20 minutes. With a mobile or maybe a knob in the side of the crib, and there was this knob. Little girls will last 5 minutes, and then they'll get bored. They'll start crying. They want you to pick them up. They want the relationship. That, again, I'm generalizing, but the points are applicable in most cases. The results, I want to talk a little bit in terms of young children. Some of the results of all of this, as it works out in the ripple effect as we grow, little girls have the edge in learning to read and write when they're 5 or 6 years old. They simply do. Most of them want to. Very frankly, most little boys when they're 5 or 6 don't want to learn to read and write. They don't want to. They're not ready for it. They don't care for it. It isn't any fun. It isn't spatial. It's sort of verbal. Our school systems have been dominated primarily by women. That's the fault of the men. Men should have gone into teaching too more than they have. But there's a predominance of women who then play clearly to the special developed verbal skills of the little girls, because they were little girls once themselves. So verbal stuff, reading, writing, oh, this is fun. Little girls like that. Oh, I have to read and write some more, teacher. Little boys are sitting there thinking, well, I ain't had enough of this stuff. I want out of here. Little boys need to use their spatial abilities. You teach a little boy at school to build a model airplane or to take apart a clock. He'll love school. He'll look forward to going. He may not be ready when he's 5 or 6 to do what the little girls are ready to do, but they're not ready to do what he is ready to do. But the problem is the teachers tend to focus on what the little girls are ready to do. So we get a whole generation of young boys growing up turned off to schooling, turned off to education, because the whole system is geared toward developing the verbal skills of tiny 5, 6, 7, and 8-year-old girls. And it lasts all of our lives. How many little boys, when they get to be 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, are in reading remedial classes? How many little girls are? the classes are 80 to 90% boys. How many boys are dyslexic? How many little girls are dyslexic? There are dyslexic girls, but there aren't very many. They're primarily boys. Can't society somehow see what it is doing to the male child as it grows by ignoring its male specificity? Because you can't do that, otherwise we turn them off. And we've done that far too much. And I just get very frustrated with the school system. If your system isn't showing some respect toward your little boy, your seven-year-old specificity, you need to go in and talk to the principal, whom I hope may be a man in some cases. I hope so. And tell him you're disappointed. Tell him I love you too much. And some parts of the country don't do that anymore. In New York State, they have some wonderful programs going where they take this into consideration. I hope they have in this area, too. My instincts say they probably don't. It's basically up in Canada, they do. New York, parts of Pennsylvania, over around Philadelphia, they do. Then some in traditional areas, you know, just teach the little girls and let the little boys sit there and fidget and fight. A few other things about little boys and little girls. When they're very little, children will express about the same degree of emotion in a visceral way. And, you know, a three-year-old boy will cry as much as a three-year-old girl. But 30-year-old men don't cry as much as 30-year-old women. What happens in the middle? I'll tell you what happens in the middle. The shape of the emotion is, apparently, they say, on the right side of the brain. And when the little fetus is developing in the womb, they see no difference in the development of the right side, the emotional side between the male and the female. And that part of the brain. It seems that at ages 1, 2, and 3, little kids, little tiny kids, little babies, are about the same. About as affectionate, about as loving, cry as much. Sometimes boy babies will cry more than girl babies, louder. What happens? Well, around age 3 or 4, you do notice differences, don't you, between the two. Some of it may be natural as a result of some of this brain dominance. Some of it is the result of reinforcement by society and by other adult males who are uncomfortable with demonstrations of emotions by other males. And they'll pass the message on to the little boys. And the little boys figure out very quickly that it's unmanly to cry. And by the time they're 5 or 6, they're already trying to hold it back and not cry as much as their sister might have at the same age. So there is a conscious limiting of emotional displays by little boys. That starts the process, and I'll tell you what it leads to. There are other things that inhibit the emotional development of boys. There's the fact that little boys will gravitate towards activities such as sports that meet their spatial needs. And sports do not have an emotional basis overall. It's not emotional. You don't kick the ball. I mean, you kick the ball, you don't kick people, necessarily. I mean, in some sports you do, but that's not the initial goal. It's a ball. It's inanimate, you see. It's spatial. That develops. Most little girls at the same time are hugging a doll. Now, the doll is inanimate, but they're pretending that the doll is a person. Do you see the difference? Little boys do not hug their soccer ball. Little girls do hug their dolly. What's happening? Well, the little girl is showing emotion. She's learning that it's fine to hug. It's fine to kiss. It's fine to be caring. The little boy is slowly moving away from those things. He's losing some of that that he naturally had. It was 2 or 3. 3-year-old boys will hug a doll. But not many 7-year-old boys will. Something's been lost. Because their verbal abilities are less developed than girls, and the school system keeps them undeveloped. And then maybe the brain itself doesn't give them as much facility in the verbal area until they're 10, 11, or 12. It does become harder for boys to verbalize feelings and to express themselves openly in the area of feelings. Now, they do have feelings, and they do feel feelings, but it is harder for them to verbalize them. So as little boys grow up, they start putting walls around the emotional area of their life. Girls don't do that, boys do. They build walls. And if something's emotional, if something is hurtful, if something is sensitive, they build a wall around it. They don't talk about it. They try to ignore it. They pretend it isn't there. They don't want to cry in public. They put up the walls. Little girls don't put up those walls. It's just there. If it's sad, if it hurts them, they cry. When they're 7, 10, 12, or 15, they cry. Boys don't do that to the same degree. Something starts to happen. Nature and nurture start to intertwine. A personal example might help crystallize some of that, some of those differences. I stressed in it, one point I stressed was that discipline should be restricted to times when a child has been truly rebellious. I mean, has been really bad, not used as a cure-all for every problem that comes along. It ought to be a last resort for serious behavior, not the first resort. A lot of us back in the 60s thought it was the first thing to do, just spank them right off. I'm sorry, but that ain't the way the Bible tells it, and that's not going to work out well with your kids. And some of us have found that out. I use myself in the sermon as a bad example of improperly used discipline when I was a young father. I told of the day when I took my three little girls to see the movie Bambi. That was back in 1967, I guess it was. I mean, good long time ago. We were living in Paris, France at the time, and there was a theater on the Champs-Élysées in the center of Paris showing Bambi. So I took my three little daughters. Susie was, I think, five, and the twins were three. I have three twin daughters that were three then, not three now. And I took my three daughters to see Bambi, and they loved the movie until it got to the part where the hunter shot Bambi's mother. Now, you may remember that part of the movie. You know, there's a shot ringing out, and then you can hear the hunters yelling, you know, "We bagged the doe!" And then you can hear the sad, plaintive voice of little Bambi crying, you know, "Mother!" Remember that voice? I mean, it just turns me to jelly. "Mother! Mother, where are you?" You remember that voice? I mean, it knocks you out. Now, Mother, of course, was dead, shot by the hunters, and Bambi, the fawn, was all alone. Now, at that point, my three tiny daughters all burst into tears. They were overwhelmed by the emotion of the death of Bambi's mother. They had never really faced death before, I don't think. Certainly the twins at age three had not, and I don't think Susie had. And I couldn't get them to stop. Now, remember, I didn't have one little kid crying. I had three little kids crying. And, you know, kids will work on each other, and when one cries, the other cries, and then they start crying louder and louder, and everybody, you know, and I was sitting in a movie theater in Paris, France, and I'll tell you, the French people, all you've heard about them, said, "Well, no, it's not all true, but some of it is. I mean, they can be pretty mean characters when they don't like what you're doing," and those people didn't like all the noise my kids were making. People were turning around looking at me with fire in their eyes, you know, tell those kids to shut up. And I couldn't. There was no way that they would stop. I finally told them, "If you don't stop, I'll have to take you out and spank you." And they didn't stop. That actually made it worse. So I took them out to the bathroom, and one by one, when you got three little kids, that takes a while to do that, one by one, I spanked them for crying in the theater as a result of the death of Bambi's mother, which was the last thing that I should have done. You know why it was inappropriate to spank? Because, you see, they were in mourning. And the response to mourning is tears. They were grieving because Bambi's mother had died. And they were simply expressing their grief. They were not being rebellious. They were not bad children. Somehow, in my youthful way, I thought, "These are bad children. They have rebelled against me. I told them to stop." I was very wrong in what I did. And I apologized to them, and actually, in giving it before the church, I sort of apologized to the whole church. Well, it was the wrong thing to do. And, you know, that was 24, 25 years ago. You may remember that example, my bad example, but there's a sequence to it. I call it Bambi 2. Bambi 2. See, my eldest daughter, who was 4 or 5 at the time, that's Susie, when she saw Bambi, she was about almost 5. She now has a little boy, my eldest grandson, and his name is Jeffrey, and he's now almost 6, but he was, 3 years ago, he was about 3. And at the age of 3, his mommy and daddy were given a copy of Bambi by another church member. You know, the video thing. They have a VCR. And they could play it for Jeffrey, and the church member thought it would be nice for Jeffrey to see Bambi. And so they said thank you for the video and took it home. There was some concern. The movie's fascinating for little kids, but my daughter remembered her reaction and her sister's reaction to the shooting of Bambi's mother. So they were worried that little Jeffrey might be emotionally shocked, as they had been, and would get very upset. So they talked about it. But on reflection, they decided to let him see it, and if he became too emotionally distraught, they decided they would stop the film, and they would then use it as an opportunity to talk a little bit about death and to gently help Jeffrey understand that an animal can die. I mean, he was 3, and he had never really faced that issue, and they thought it might be a learning experience and it would be okay. They certainly weren't going to spank him, as I had done, if he got upset. Well, they felt this anxiety, but it was decided to show him the film and then to work with his reaction, you know, to help him through it, that it would be maybe a good thing to do as a family. Jeffrey loved the story, of course. It is exciting. I mean, Bambi is just fascinating for little kids. And he was just as fascinated as his mommy had been 23 years earlier. And then the plot approached the crisis point, you know, when the shots ring out and the hunters begin to shout, "We bagged the doe! We gotta go!" And Bambi, you know, begins to cry, "Mother! Mother, where are you?" And at that point, you know, all eyes are on little Jeffrey. How would he react? What would he do? Would he lose control? Jeffrey didn't disappoint. He never does. On cue, he stood up. He's sitting down. He stood up. His eyes got wide. And he began to shine. And he said, "Daddy, can you buy me a gun so I can go hunting?"
And shoot animals, too?
Difference, don't you think? You say, oh, there's no difference. Nah, it's just the same. It's his cultural, you know. Now, his mummy and his aunts 22 years previously focused on the relationship between Bambi and Bambi's mother. Little Jeffrey focused on the action of the hunt. And he was so excited by the noise of the hunt, he wanted a gun so he could shoot animals, too. He bypassed the emotional side to it. He was only 3 years old. He was already doing it. They see, as we grow, we males continue to bypass the emotional side of things. We keep on putting up the walls. It is easier for us. But it gets us in trouble, big trouble. And later on, as converted adults, we got to take the wall down somewhat. I'll get to that in a couple of minutes. As a young boy gets older, his ability to bypass his feelings and not focus on emotions gets so much stronger, in part because of his natural tendencies, I think, but in part also because of the pressure that male society places upon him. Now, we get to the interesting time. That's the teens, you know. As they get into the teens, the boys are putting up higher and higher walls. They're getting more and more interested in spatial things, sports. Walls are getting higher. They're ignoring that part of life. The girls aren't. The girls are getting more and more interested in feelings, in relationships, in developing a relationship with a boy, having a boy friend, but also having girl friends. Girls develop very intense relationships in their teens with other girls. You know what they do when they develop those relationships? They share secrets. They talk about their feelings. They talk about what's going on in here. Now, teenage boys develop relationships too, but they don't talk about what's going on in here. They share activities, yes, but they don't share feelings. Teenage boys, you know, hunt together or play basketball together or play checkers together, but they don't discuss personal items to any great degree. If a teenage boy wants to discuss something really personal, he'll talk to his mom. He probably won't talk to his dad. He'll talk to his mom, but he won't talk to his buddies. But teenage girls do talk to their friends a lot. So the boys are putting up the walls. The girls are looking at the boys saying, how can I get over that wall? The boys don't know that the girl's favorite activity is tearing down the wall and getting in there and making the boys talk about feelings. This is the last thing the boys want to do. 2 years later, we get into our 20s and we get married. Do you understand what that means? We get into our 20s and we marry. On the surface, a lot of newlyweds remain oblivious to the differences between one another. They're lost in this pink fog. But then someday along the road, usually at about the fourth year of marriage, reality hits and the pink fog lifts. It will lift. If you've been married a year and a half, I assure you, the pink fog will lift. Yes, it will. And you start looking at each other and saying, hey, wait a minute. I didn't know he emotionally bypassed like that. I didn't notice it. People forget, and maybe they never knew why God made us different and what we can do about it when that reality finally hits us in the face, as it will. I want to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. There's a beautiful little verse that puts it all in a very positive context for us. 1 Corinthians 11, beginning in about verse 7. The early part of the chapter focuses on the physical differences in appearance between men and women. It indicates in the first part of the chapter that men are to wear their hair in a shorter style, women are to wear their hair in a longer style. And the only reason for that is for us to focus on the fact that we're different. It just helps us see that we're different. We are different. God designed it. Not just that there be physical differences, but there are mental and emotional differences, even different ways in which we view our lives spiritually. That's sort of interesting, too. You know, women verbalize better. I can promise you, men have a harder time praying than women do. Did you know that? More men battle with prayer than women because women have an easier time talking, so they can more easily talk to God. Men battle with prayer far more than women do. Men, on the other hand, study their Bibles in general more than women do because it doesn't talk to you. But men feel safer when it doesn't talk to you. You can just read it, you see, close it up, put it away. They won't talk back. Yeah, we even put our spiritual life in a kind of a different way. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7, I lost my place here. I'm going to show you a little point. A man indeed, verse 7, ought not to cover his head for as much as he's the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. Now, that's not a demeaning statement. That word glory means reflection. It also means substance. It's a very strong word. It implies she adds something of worth and of great value to his life that would not be there otherwise. For the man is not of the woman, verse 8, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. To bring completion into his life. To bring into his life an approach and a way of doing things that he doesn't particularly have and doesn't even identify with initially, but that he needs to understand and that he needs to inculcate into his life, at least up to a point. There's a kind of a blending that'll begin to happen. And God wants that blend to occur. And, you know, for marriage to work, you got to take the walls down somewhat. It just forces you to do it. You'll never take them down totally. But on the other hand, a wife needs to understand why her husband has those walls and why they're there, and be patient with him as he, you know, sort of tentatively begins to take some of them down. It's pretty hard for a lot of men to do. Before we look at how God helps you take those walls down and how he helps us blend our differences, I want to do something for a couple of minutes. Over the past several years, I began to list the areas of conflict that people wanted to discuss when they came to talk about their troubled marriages. People always have a certain focus. And I began to jot it down in a book. This was discussed, and I saw some patterns. And I want to list the specific sources of irritation that come up time and time again. And I'll put them in basic order of frequency. And we'll start with the irritants women want to discuss about husbands. And I'll add a comment or two at the end of each. And then I'll talk to you about the irritants men want to discuss in terms of their wife. Concern number one by the ladies, and I quote one lady directly in this: "My husband has shut me out of his life emotionally. He doesn't share his feelings with me. If he's in pain or he's frustrated or he's unhappy, he isolates himself. We go back in our cave. Or, if I try to help and discuss it, either he becomes more distant or he gets angry." So you see, there are other guys that get out there and they get mad when their wife sort of, you know, wants them to open up emotionally. And then there are the guys that run back and hide in the cave. We tend to do one or the other. I'm a caveman myself. I go back in the cave. And my wife has to sort of coax me out. You know, "Let's discuss this issue, honey." "No, I'm back here. I don't want to talk about it. Back here. I don't discuss those things. I'm male." I hide in a cave. I don't know what you do. There are some men, however, that get mad and you know, they're ready to, you know, have indulge in fisticuffs. Most of us hide in caves. My comment is this: men feel emotions deep within them. But ladies, the walls have gone up over the years. Please respect that. It is so hard for a man to self-disclose. He has never disclosed intimate information about himself to virtually anybody. Now, you talk about intimate stuff to every woman. View self-disclosure as the heart of a meaningful relationship. You have talked about intimate things to your mother, to your sisters, to your dorm mates, to ministers. Men only disclose intimate stuff about themselves when they're drunk. That's why, you know, these... You know, in the bars, the guy in the bar and the guys sitting on the stools getting, you know, drunker and drunker, and finally they begin to open up. Then the walls come down. It's just hard. It's hard. My advice to women who have a husband that emotionally bypasses is this: just be patient. Gently talk about your need to know what's going on in his life, how he feels about things, but don't push it too hard. If you keep on pushing him, he's going to go back into his cave, and ultimately some men simply stay in there and never come out, and that certainly isn't going to be helpful in your marriage. Try to be understanding about this. Concern number two that comes up, this is so frequent: "My husband," women say, "is a workaholic. Home and family are secondary. He's obsessed with his professional life." I got a direct quote from one wife: "My husband is little more than a machine for work. If I had known his great loving life would be work and I would be a hobby on the side, the kids and I would never have married him. We are just an afterthought." My comment: God designed a man's brain in such a way that he will tend to focus first and foremost on goal setting, work, and achievement. And candidly, work and achievement should be a major focus in his life, but it shouldn't be the only one. But you see, society has built a system in which so many men feel that tasks and achievement are the only real important focus, and they can become the only focus. Now, that's wrong, but it's easy for that to happen. Society has pushed the good God-designed tendency way too far and reinforce the male task orientation to an excessive extreme. So as a result, it's easy for many men to define themselves only in terms of their job or their profession. My advice to wives with a workaholic husband is the following: when he falls into it, please don't be shocked. Any decent guy will fall into it at some point in his life. He shouldn't. I don't like it. It's neglecting his family. But decent men do fall into workaholism rather easily. It uses what's here. He specializes. That he's specializing in his work a little bit too much. Bring it up to him. Talk to him about it compassionately. Don't say, "I'll divorce you unless you change." He's going back in his cave as soon as you pull that on him. That won't work. Now, that'll be your tendency. I say that lovingly. I want you to change that. He's back in his cave, and you cut off the communication, and you've done it in this case. Maybe he normally does it, but there you've done it. Doesn't work. Tell him, however. There's nothing wrong with telling. Not crabbing, not nagging. Telling is a very different issue. Tell him you want him at home more. Tell him the kids need him. Tell him lovingly, and then pray about it. And then tell him again 6 months down the road. Keep at it lovingly. It's going to work someday. If you got a decent guy, he's going to get his priorities straight. It's easy for men to get them out of sync. Concern number three, in order of frequency, my husband won't ask for help when he's in trouble. Either he denies that there is a problem, or he minimizes it, or he tries to solve it on his own when it's clear that he can't. My comment is this. Certain reluctance to admit failure seems to be built into all men who are strongly goal-oriented, and they need to be goal-oriented. And it's hard to admit failure. Men are programmed, you see, by society to attack problems and to solve them. It's very hard to admit that you've lost control. That's why if you get lost in a strange neighborhood, women stop the car immediately and ask for directions. Men don't want to stop. Men don't want to stop. You know why? Because it is an admitting of failure. You know, if I'm driving through a neighborhood and I know as I was about 2 hours ago and I didn't know where I was, I had no idea. I did stop because you were in here and you created pressure. I stopped about 5 times. Now, if you hadn't been here, I probably wouldn't have stopped at all. You see, my wife would be saying, oh, look, there's a convenience store. Stop and get directions. And I'd be saying, yeah, I'm looking in the window of that convenience store, and there's a guy in there. He looks like Michael Jordan. Yeah, he's 6'9", and he's behind that. I'm going to go in and tell Michael Jordan, I'm lost. I can't solve the problem, and can you please help me out? There's no way I'm going to do that. No way. Now, if there's an old lady in there, look, she looks to be 110, and she's 3 feet tall, I'll ask her. But they don't tend to work in convenience stores. I don't know why. What is it about men? Well, you know, women, on the other hand, don't mind admitting failure, especially in secondary areas of life. It's considered to be an acceptable glitch. In fact, I found that women enjoy discussing failures, blow by blow. It's cathartic. 90% of the people who come to see me as a minister for counsel are women. And yet the Church of God is 53% male and 47% female in our statistical breakdown. A few more men than women are in the church. But those guys don't come and talk to me. And I don't go and talk to them. Now, what is the problem? Well, women don't mind admitting that they made a mistake because their conditioning allows that. They have permission to say, hey, I blew it. What do I do now? Men don't have the same permission. What do you do when there's a problem? Well, ladies, I would say this. Encourage your husband to come for counsel. But above all, see it from his goal-oriented, problem-solving point of view. It's very hard for him to do it. Pray about it. You can ask the minister to request that your husband come in for counsel because he probably won't go if that doesn't happen in most cases when there is a true problem. It is simply very hard. Be sympathetic is what I'm trying to say. Understand it. It won't change things a lot, but it'll make it a lot easier to put up with the guy. You follow what I'm saying? Hopefully someday you'll see the need to humble himself and admit that he is making some mistakes. It is a question of humility, and all of us males have to learn that kind of humility. I want to move to the other side quickly now, and I do get a few brave men to come in for counsel, and there aren't many, but if you come in, what are their concerns about areas of conflict? I've listed them for many years, and I want to give you a couple of them quickly. 90% of the time it revolves around the classic differences that we've already been discussing. Few men come in and want to discuss sex with me, by the way. Few men say, I have a sexual problem in my marriage. That is very, very rare that occurs. I'll tell you what they do say. Concern number one that I've jotted down, by far the most common, quote, my wife tends to be ruled by her emotions and uses them to manipulate me. When we have a problem, this is what one guy said to me, I sit down with my wife and I try to discuss it logically and factually, but at that point she doesn't want logic. She doesn't want facts. She wants to vent. And I simply can't sit there and vent with her. If I had known this woman was so totally ruled by her emotions, that's what men say. They shouldn't. That's an overreaction. I don't think I would have married her, etc., etc., etc. I have a comment on this. Women are more emotional than men. I think you understand better today why. And they need those deeper wells. I feel God arranged us in such a way that the wells are deeper in most women. They're deeper because women, in general, are the part of our society that are responsible mainly for raising children. And if you didn't have those deeper wells, you would have sold your kids to some, I don't know, to whoever was out there buying them years ago. You got to have the deeper wells, otherwise kids can drive you nuts. Kids can drive you crazy. Kids can make life so difficult without the deeper wells. You know as well as I do, if you got 5 kids and you leave your husband at home with them for 5 hours and you go shopping, when you come home, he has had it. You think, man, you know, well, the wells aren't quite as deep. Women also have to put up with the foibles of husbands. Men do tend to have more foibles than women do. Specialization. We tend to be a little bit more eccentric. We get a little bit more into this and lose the overview sometimes. That can be hard for a woman to take. She's got to have the deeper wells, otherwise she would have sold us to the people out there that would buy us a long time ago. You can thank the Eternal that He made your wife in such a way that the wells are deeper. You need to respect that, not caricature it, or complain about it. It is of God, and it is important. Concern number two, voiced by so many men, my wife seems to resent my job. I work like a dog to give her a nice house, a nice this, a nice that. She doesn't appreciate it. She's always dogging me about the job. She's always saying, oh, I ought to come home at 5 o'clock, not work till 7. My comment is this. It's important to men that their wives value and admire their achievements. Remember, men in general are doers. Women in general are beers. It's a little bit more important for women to be a part of our relationship. Men focus a little bit more on tasks and jobs. And so what a man achieves in life takes on importance that many wives do not fully grasp or understand. And yet the importance and the value is there. If your husband is a workaholic, you shouldn't put up with that. You should tell him gently and lovingly and frequently that you need him more in the home and the family. Don't, however, go to the other extreme and give the impression that his job is not important. It is important to him. To a man, work gives life, meaning, and direction. And without a decent job and a decent profession, a man loses direction. He loses meaning in life. Life doesn't have the same significance. A man can then become withdrawn. He can become angry. He can become defensive. It is so incredibly traumatic to a man to be unemployed. Just trauma is there. And you need to understand the third concern, and I got to wrap it up in a couple of minutes here. I've heard it time and time again. Men said to me frequently, when there's a conflict in our marriage, my wife begins to nag. She doesn't shelve it. She won't let it go. She won't set it aside. She keeps needling me until I get so angry I could, whatever. I could spit. I could put my fist through the living room wall. I mean, I've heard all of the analogies. What about the nagging situation? Women want a perfect relationship with their family. They want a perfect relationship with their husband, and they want to have a perfect relationship with their kids. It's very important. When that does not seem to be happening, women do tend to panic. They become a little, maybe the word unglued is too strong. Insecurity is suddenly built. It's not perfect. They want a successful family more than anything else. When that doesn't seem to be happening, many women will become a little emotionally distraught, and at that point, this starts happening. The jabs. The verbal ones, not the physical ones. It's called nagging. It does begin to happen. When women are secure in their husband's love and affection, they won't tend to nag. So if your wife is naggy, it's because she's not quite sure that you're as involved as you should be and that you love them as much as you ought to love them. There's a lack of security there. That doesn't justify the nagging, but it does maybe tend to help you understand why it's there. Okay, what are the solutions? And I'll quickly get to those. Turn to Ephesians 5. You'll see the solutions are spiritual. We are different. We do need God and the Spirit of God working within us to blend our natures together, to weld and to meld them together. Ephesians chapter 5 verse 21 tells us how God does that. Marriage was designed to be a spirit plane relationship, and the blending can occur, but God must be involved. Ephesians 5 verse 21. A great principle in marriage. Submit yourselves one to another in the fear of God. This is not hierarchical submission. Who's in charge? It's mutual submission. It involves each adapting to the needs and the expectations and the differences in approach of the other. Submit one to another in the fear of God. Well, how do we do that? What are the main needs of a wife? They tend to be emotional needs. Are you fulfilling your wife's emotional needs? Are you even trying to fulfill them? Is it even important to you? What are man's primary needs? Well, they tend to be centered on the fulfillment of goals and tasks. Are you backing him up in that? Are you trying to help him develop the goals in life that are important to him? Are you with him in those things? Verse 21, after you submit to one another, some other things have to begin to happen. Verse 25, notice, husbands, love your wives. That sums up the needs of the wives in so many words. And why does God tell the man to do that? One, because women need to be loved. Two, because men don't seem to have quite the sufficient reserves to fulfill all of those needs. And we have to be reminded of it an awful lot. We don't have necessarily the makeup that's needed to sufficiently fulfill those needs. God says we can, though, with His Spirit. Love is a fruit of the Spirit, remember. We have to learn to love our wives, and this is exactly where we tend to be remiss. Now, verse 33 addresses the wives, nonetheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself. We've already seen that. And the wife see that she respects her husband. Now, why say that? Why not say the wife, that she loves her husband? Well, because in most cases she does. It's a little easier. In most cases that has already occurred. See that she respects him. In many cases that has never occurred. Men need respect. Women need to give it, but they need to give it primarily because men need to receive it. Men need respect to feel motivated to conquer new horizons, and when you deprive them of it, a lot of men get confused and feel inadequate, and they begin to withdraw from you. And when you get the overview in Ephesians 5, as I've given you very quickly, you can begin to see that God made us as we are. Beautiful overview. Submit one to another. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. See the needs of the other. Respect the differences. I'll just give you a couple of suggestions in closing that you can think about if you have a problematic marriage. And all of them are tributary to the working of God's Spirit and to the instructions of Paul in Ephesians chapter 5. If your husband, pray for love daily. Pray for God to give you love through His Spirit so you can express His love to your wife. Only through His love working in you can you really express to your wife the degree of love that she needs to receive. Another recommendation, verbalize your love and your concern for your wife daily in some way. That's called reassurance. Women very quickly begin to doubt your commitment to the relationship because that's their main focus and they think about it quite a bit of the time. That's why the wife got unsaid when the husband came home and didn't talk. The immediate reaction is to say, what's wrong? He's leaving me out. He doesn't love me. Something's happening. He doesn't want me to be a part of it. That's very, very unsettling. Reassurance is vital. Verbalize it daily. And then if you're a man, every 6 months, sit down and reanalyze your priorities. They should be as follows. God first, family second, job third. This is easy for a man to get the order jumbled and to end up with job first, God second, family third. When that occurs, she'll begin to nag. I promise you, unless she is so incredibly mature, unless you're married to a spiritual paragon, the paragon in the congregation, she will probably begin to nag, and that's your cue to begin to analyze the priorities right away. Before the whole thing begins to, come unglued. Wives in a troubled marriage, it's just the exact opposite in terms of recommendations. A wife should pray daily for the ability to express love for her husband, but within the context of respect for his accomplishments. You join love and respect together, and some of our wives have never done that. Some of you love your husband just, he's the greatest guy. You love him to pieces, but you don't respect him and he knows it. You got a problem. Compliment him on his professional achievements. He wants to get a degree and he says, can you go back to work for a couple of years? And you say, I work for 2 years, you get his dumb degree. My reaction is, if I were you and the kids are in school, I think I'd consider doing that so he can get his dumb degree. Because maybe that'll turn his life around in yours too. Express pride when he gets a promotion. Deep down, all men battle this deep sense of inadequacy when it comes to what we attempt to accomplish in life. Because life tells us, accomplish, fella. Accomplish. Get something done. Do something meaningful with your life. And when we're not, it is a real battle for us. Help your man to accomplish. Be behind him. Validate him. Second recommendation, when your husband does neglect your relationship, and even the best husband in the world will do that on occasion, and you feel insecure, ask God for the self-control not to nag, not to badger, not to be on his back continuously. It won't help. He'll be back in the cave, and it's not going to help. It won't solve anything. I know your mother did that. 90% of your mothers did that. That was the American system 50 years ago. Mom's badgered, dad went back in the cave, went to the bar, went downtown to the honky-tonk, sat on the street corner with his buddies. Don't do it. There's no fun back in the cave. No fun back. No guy really wants to be back in there. But he'll go back there. That's what he's been socialized to do. Third recommendation, ask God to help you assess your emotional needs as a woman, your husband's ability to meet them. And if they don't mesh as yet, if he is still too limited in terms of his ability to meet your emotional needs, talking and all of that, then you need to strengthen some other relationships in your life and find some needed fulfillment there too. Most women need a strong relationship with your mother. It's worth the expense. Go see your mother's in Chicago, go see her. Go. It'll take the pressure off your marriage. Most women need a strong relationship with their sisters. Most women need a very close female friend that you can talk to and share with. Your husband is meant to be the number one relationship in your life, not the only relationship in your life. If he is the only relationship you have, he He will probably not be able to fulfill all of your relationship needs. You will then blame him for your growing sense of frustration, and that isn't fair. It just isn't fair, okay? You need a girlfriend. You need a strong relationship with other women. Open up the other channels. Pray that God will allow your husband to come to a point at which he does meet more of those needs, and he should be praying along the same line. Husbands, love your wives. But you got to look realistically at the point at which he's come through right now. You got to, and you got to deal with that and make yourself happy. I want to turn in closing to Matthew chapter 19. You dissect the problems people have in marriage. It's not simplistic to say that 80 to 90% of them were pinpointed by the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 5. Matthew chapter 19, verse 5. Paul said, submit one to another, respect each other, love each other, try to fulfill each other's needs. Men try to fulfill the emotional needs of your wives. Wives learn to respect and to validate your husbands. You say, well, that's sort of simplistic. No, I think that's real deep. I think what Paul said in Ephesians 5 is real deep stuff. And if you apply what he said, 80 to 90% of what has gone wrong can begin to go right. Matthew chapter 19, verse 5 is a good verse to close on. For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave to his wife. And the cleaving is mentally and physically and emotionally on all levels. And they twain shall be one flesh. But the one flesh physically is simply a picture of the union mentally and the union spiritually and the union emotionally. But that can only come through the indwelling of the Spirit of God as it joins these two dissimilar human beings who love one another together. God can do that, brethren. Jesus Christ in you is the hope of glory. Jesus Christ in you is the hope of a happy marriage. He can blend the two. Wherefore, there are no more twain, but one flesh. But God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Now, God joins us together officially the day we're married, but he continues to do the joining daily, and you need to ask him to do that, to blend you, so you can become one, and you can pool the resources, and you can work together. I've been married almost 30 years, and I made some major mistakes when it all started out. It was not the best way to start a marriage union at all. But we hung in there, and with God's help, we've made it into a good marriage. Now, I still do things that make it hard to cleave. I'm still insensitive. I still tend to bypass. I got pretty high walls because I came from the kind of a background where you hit everything. You didn't talk about those things. I put up the walls, and I try to, you know, bring them down and let my wife sort of in there, and then I put them back up, and I bring them down, and I'm still battling that battle. I'm good at denying that there's a problem. I don't deny quite as much as I used to, but I still deny when she's saying, well, this is an issue, and I'm saying, well, maybe it's a little issue, and she knows it's a big one, and I ought to know that too. But some progress has been made. Ask God to help you cleave, and with his help and the operation of God's Spirit, you can have a happy marriage. That I promise you, and it can last 30 years or 50 years or 100 years. With God's help, all of that is possible. Good to be